Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Russia's Sputnik Radio, Spanish National Radio, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We'll begin with Sputnik Radio, the modern name for the Voice of Russia. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with 3 guests about the American targeted assassination of Iranian General Soleimani. First, he speaks with the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Danny Elian, about nuclear deterrence, why the U.S. would choose to murder an ally in the elimination of ISIS, and Putin's relationship with Israel. Next is Iraqi MP Saeed al-Mutalabi, who talks about Iraqi rage over the U.S. assassination of Deputy Chief Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was murdered along with Soleimani. The U.S. has not apologized for what they see as collateral damage. Saeed also explains the purpose of Soleimani's visit was to present a peace proposal to the Iraqi prime minister from Saudi Arabia. Then Afshin speaks with Jeffrey Robertson, QC, who discusses Donald Trump's threat to target Iranian cultural sites, for which he calls the U.S. president a barbarian and suggests that U.S. generals will likely disobey the order to avoid being prosecuted for war crimes. Sputnik Radio.
The world is not the same since Donald Trump ordered the killing of Iranian soldier Qasem Soleimani, who, along with his Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit counterparts, were drone-striked on Friday at Baghdad Airport. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Danny Ayalon. It wasn't too long ago that even corporate media was celebrating in the West General Soleimani for his defeat of ISIS-Daesh, which some have linked to Israel after the famous pictures of Netanyahu in the Golan Heights. Frankly, isn't the point that if Iran had a nuclear weapon, this assassination wouldn't have taken place? And the fact that, and that's the reason, as a deterrent, that Israel has nuclear weapons, which apparently Netanyahu has finally admitted in the past few days.
I believe that a few years back, the United States was cooperating with Soleimani against ISIS, against Daesh. But since Soleimani turned on the Americans, then they had no choice but to defend themselves. As to the point of the nuclear policy of Israel, we have said it, and Netanyahu actually reiterated, Israel will not be the first to introduce a nuclear weapon in the Middle East.
I've got to ask you, given Vladimir Putin has arrived for talks with Assad, President Assad in Syria, do you think that Moscow and Beijing may be looking on this and thinking Israel is on the same side as Iran against ISIS? Why can't these countries all come back together?
President Putin, of course, is very much respected here in Israel. You know that we have more than one and a half million Israelis who came out of Russian descent. By the way, he's also scheduled to be here, I believe, in about a week or so. And he's always welcome here. And of course, we would very much like to see if Russia can use their influence in Damascus, in Tehran, maybe something can come out of it.
Ambassador, thank you. Well, joining me now from the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, where Qasem Soleimani was assassinated, is member of Baghdad Council Security Committee, Saad al-Matlabi. NATO nation state-backed media here is saying that the vote in the Iraqi parliament to throw out British and American soldiers is only advisory. Does it actually mean anything?
It does, because the Prime Minister, his intention was to ask all foreign troops outside Iraq. And he needed the political backing from the parliament. As we know, Iraqi parliament is divided upon itself, and he wanted a political following or political backing so he could go and face the American and the foreign troops behind him, a political force.
So it actually does mean that the troops have to leave, or what is the next stage of this since the vote?
Yes. You see, in 2014, a letter was sent from the Foreign Office, Iraqi Foreign Office, to the Security Council at the United Nations, asking for international assistance. Now the job is finished, ISIS is finished, so now Foreign Office will send another letter to the Security Council asking to revoke that old letter and thank you very much, we don't need your forces anymore. We have got rid of ISIS, so you can all go home.
And of course, Mr. Soleimani was the man credited with getting rid of ISIS.
The Americans assassinated the other day a top-ranking Iraqi personnel general who answers directly to the Prime Minister, who is the deputy head of the Public Mobilization Forces, which is the force that actually defeated ISIS. And they assassinated this Iraqi general just because he was with Soleimani. Now, the problem with that is the Americans never apologized. They didn't say that we didn't know that he was there. They didn't explain themselves. They just shot him, killed the man, and turned him to pieces, and they're talking about Soleimani. We're not really concerned about Soleimani. We're concerned of our general. The parliament is enraged because of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, not because of Soleimani. The streets in Baghdad filled with people because of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, not because of Soleimani.
Of course, Donald Trump initially said there was an imminent attack on U.S. troops, which justified the assassination strike. It's now emerged that Soleimani was in Baghdad with plans for some kind of rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Why would Baghdad be the place where this kind of communication might have happened, and of course the prospects for peace right across the region?
Baghdad is accused of having very close relationship to Iran. So somebody wanted to make use of this accusation. We developed in the last few years a better relationship with the Saudis. And the tension between those two countries basically are affecting the policies, our security policy in Iraq. So he was passing these important messages between two sides. He had actually an appointment with the Prime Minister at 8:30 on the eve that he was assassinated to bring the Iranian reply or Mr. Khamenei's eminence, Mr. Khamenei's reply to the Saudi proposal.
Saad al-Matlabi, thank you.
Thank you.
More now on the fallout of the U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani, one of the things that even President Trump's hawk supporters have distanced themselves from this week, is his apparent threat to destroy cultural heritage sites in Iran. So what should be the consequences for such a flagrant disregard for international law when it comes to culture? Joining me now for more on this and other cultural injustices is the leading human rights lawyer, Jeffrey Robertson. Your reaction to President Trump saying that the culture of Iran should be targeted?
Sadly, this is a man who thinks like a barbarian, because it is to protect against barbarian activities. Over centuries, most recently, of course, ISIS, we have developed over centuries this rule that you do not attack cultural heritage. And here is the commander of the free world, if you like, announcing that he's going to target cultural property, world heritage areas, to spite Iran. He calls it Iranian culture, but it's not. It's the culture of the world. It's cultural property that belongs to us all because it's part of our artistic and architectural evolution. And so, you know, this is a barbarian's idea of a sort of reprisal of the playground. It's not, it has nothing to do with international law. It's fit for a world in which law is absent.
Well, obviously the USA doesn't care about what happens in The Hague. It's not a member of that court and off the targets.
But American commanders do, and it's fascinating to see the initial reaction. American commanders are bred in their military schools on what is called the Lieber Code, and it makes clear that it's a war crime to attack churches, to attack cultural institutions.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo defended Trump's comments about some of the targets.
Well, Pompeo did, because he thinks like a barbarian. But the
he said it would be within the law, whatever the
USA did. Well, he's wrong about that, and everyone knows he's wrong. The generals, I think, will, for the most part, disobey Trump's command to bomb a World Heritage area, because they'll remember Nuremberg. So they will not obey those orders. It will be perhaps the end of Trump if those orders are given.
Jeffrey Robertson, QC. Thank you.
Those excerpts were from Afshin Rotansi's program Going Underground, heard on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Exterior de España, or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes begins by describing the 60 to 70,000 U.S. troops stationed around the Middle East, with 5,200 in Iraq. Professor Juan Cole says that Iraqis have ambivalent feelings toward the U.S., angry over the 2003 invasion and occupation of their country, but grateful for assistance defeating ISIS. In The Independent, Patrick Coburn argues that the only certain result of the U.S. assassination of the Iranian general in Iraq will be that Iraq will be the political and military arena for the U.S.-Iranian conflict. He also points out that General Soleimani was overseeing the brutal efforts to crush Iraqi street protests for the past 3 months. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says that Israel stands completely behind Trump's targeted assassination of the general. 2019 was the second hottest year on record, ending the hottest decade in history. Spanish National Radio.
At present, approximately 5,200 American troops are stationed in Iraq. Axios reports in 2019 there were between 60,000 and 70,000 U.S. troops stationed around the Middle East, according to the U.S. Central Command. With more than 7,000 mostly naval forces stationed in Bahrain, nearly 3,000 soldiers in Jordan, over 13,000 troops in Kuwait, a few hundred in Oman, 5,000 in United Arab Emirates, as many as 13,000 in Qatar, and some 3,000 recently deployed to Saudi Arabia, not to mention the 14,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Professor Juan Cole writes in informed comment, "Iraqis have ambivalent feelings toward the United States. They resent the 2003 Bush invasion and the 8.5 years of foreign military occupation. In 2016, polling showed that over 90% of Iraqi young people saw the U.S. as an enemy. On the other hand, many are grateful for U.S. military help in defeating ISIS, the hyper-Sunni terrorist organization that massacred Shiites. Some 5,000 U.S. troops are still in Iraq, engaging in mop-up operations alongside the Iraqi army against ISIS remnants, who still control entire villages in the Sunni north. They had also been further training the rebuilt Iraqi army, which had collapsed and run away from ISIS in 2014. Those U.S. troops are now more or less prisoners in the country and have ceased the training operation, as have NATO coalition partners. They say that they are still doing operations against ISIS, but that strikes me as wishful thinking and bravado in the current circumstances. Their colleagues in such operations, mainly Iraqi Shiite, can no longer be trusted not to frag them." That was informed comment from Juan Cole. Veteran journalist and Iraq specialist Patrick Coburn writes in The Independent that the targeted assassination of General Soleimani may not result in a full-scale military conflict, but, he argues, Iraq will be the political and military arena where the U.S.-Iranian rivalry will be fought out. Patrick Coburn notes, quote, "Ever since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, Iran has generally come out ahead of the U.S. in any struggle for influence within Iraq. The main reason for this has been that the Shia community in Iraq, two-thirds of the population and politically dominant, has looked to its fellow Shia in Iran for support against its enemies. Ironically, Iranian influence and popularity had been seriously damaged because of General Soleimani's overseeing the brutal efforts by pro-Iranian security forces and paramilitary groups to crush Iraqi street protests, killing at least 400 protesters and injuring another 15,000. Mounting Iraqi popular rage against Iran for its interference in Iraq's internal affairs is now likely to be counterbalanced by the even more blatant assault on Iraq's national sovereignty by the United States. Also killed by the drone was Abu Mahdi al-Mudanis, the leader of Kataib Hezbollah, the powerful pro-Iranian paramilitary group. The U.S. may consider paramilitary commanders like him to be evil terrorists, but for many Shia Iraqis, they are the people who fought against Saddam Hussein and who defended them against ISIS. Patrick Coburn goes on to describe the decision by General Soleimani to try to crush the protests as a big mistake, and continues, "General Soleimani died in the wake of his greatest failure and misjudgment. But the manner of his killing may convince many Shia Iraqis that the threat to Iraqi independence from the U.S. is greater than that from Iran. The next few days will tell if the protest movement, which has endured the violence used against it with so much bravery, will be deflated by the killings at the Baghdad airport. Wars are reputedly won by generals who make the fewest mistakes. General Soleimani made a bad mistake over the last 3 months by turning a modest protest into something close to a mass uprising. Trump may have made an even worse mistake by killing General Soleimani and making Iraq a place where Iran has far more going for it than the U.S., the arena in which the rivalry between these two powers will be fought out." That was a comment by veteran journalist and Middle East specialist Patrick Coburn. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reaffirmed his country's alliance with the United States and threatened retribution for any future attack on Israel. Netanyahu said in Jerusalem, "Whoever tries to attack us will be dealt the strongest blow." He also said Israel stands completely beside U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to kill Iranian General Soleimani and that Trump should be congratulated for acting swiftly, boldly, and resolutely. The French news service AFP reports that 2019 was the second hottest year on record and ended the hottest decade in history. Data released by the Copernicus Climate Change Service, the C3S, the European Union agency, showed that worldwide temperatures last year were second only to 2016. C3S said the five last years have been the hottest on record, and the period of 2010 to 2019 was the hottest decade since the records began. Last year was Europe's hottest ever. Carlo Buontempo, head of the C3S, said 2019 has been another exceptionally warm year, in fact, the second warmest globally in our data set, with many of the individual months breaking records. C3S also said that atmospheric carbon concentrations continued to rise in 2019, reaching their highest levels on record. The United Nations said last year that man-made greenhouse gas emissions needed to tumble 7.6% each year to 2030 in order to limit temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The first week of 2020 has seen climate-related disasters, such as the fires raging in southeastern Australia and flooding killing dozens of people in Indonesia. Scientists say such catastrophes will become more frequent and more intense as temperatures climb. C3S said December 2019 was 3.2 degrees Celsius warmer than the 1981 to 2010 reference period.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. In fact, of the more than 100 radio stations rebroadcasting the show last year, only one, WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, helped to finance it. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support it like an individual listener in Redwood Valley, California, an online listener in Northumberland, England, and a staff member of WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin did this week. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. A Cuban newspaper criticized the U.S. government for ongoing attempts to destabilize the country through alleged pro-democracy programs. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido has been accused of a PR stunt trying to enter parliament that has rejected him. The Arab League rejects foreign interference in Libya. Washington refused to issue a visa to the Iranian foreign minister to prevent him from speaking at the United Nations. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Granma newspaper denounced on Tuesday the maneuvers of the U.S. government aimed at destabilizing Cuba through the alleged pro-democracy programs, which finance mercenary groups, scholarships to promote fake leadership amongst young people and the dirty war on the Internet. In an article on its front page, the Cuban Communist Party newspaper reports that since 1996, the controversial Helms-Burton Act established the obligations to finance these destabilizing programs, to which Washington earmarks nearly $20 million a year. The publication also recalls that since its creation in 2018, the so-called Internet Task Force for Cuba and the institutions that make up that force have highly qualified specialists who, based on previously developed models, direct targeted messages to sectors of Cuban society and organize fake campaigns and protest actions supposedly led by Cuban users. One of the most widespread falsehoods in recent times about the Caribbean nation is that of presenting the Cuban Revolution as an enemy of the Internet. While the White House, without any pretext, with its rhetoric that the government prevents access to new technologies, uses infocommunications for anti-Cuban and interfering purposes with media such as the radio and television Martí.
Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido has been accused of pulling a PR stunt after a dramatic video showed him mounting a fence to enter the parliament as lawmakers voted to replace him as the head of the legislature. The opposition-led National Assembly changed its leadership over the weekend, with the majority of lawmakers electing Luis Parra, a deputy from the Primero Justicia, a party in opposition to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's United Socialist Party. One of the absentees was U.S.-backed opposition figurehead Juan Guaido, the now former leader of the National Assembly, who proclaimed himself the country's interim president a year ago. Guaido and a group of his followers were recorded attempting to climb a fence surrounding the legislature, with uniformed security guards pulling them back. The video was picked up by mainstream media in the West, which spun it as evidence of Guaido being barred from participating in the key parliamentary vote. But other footage shows Guaido chatting with members of the National Guard and refusing to enter the building unless his followers, five other deputies who were stripped of parliamentary immunity pending criminal prosecution, are allowed inside. When his plea was rejected, Guaido complained and attempted to storm the building. After his show failed, Guaido convened a parallel assembly at an office of the pro-opposition El Nacional newspaper. His supporters re-elected Guaido and swore him in as the parliament's leader, proclaiming the National Assembly vote unlawful.
Following an emergency meeting in Cairo, Egypt, to discuss the Libyan situation, the permanent delegates of the Arab League said Tuesday they reject foreign interference in Libya, which has been ravaged by war for over 8 years. The Arab League Council highlighted the need to prevent interference that could contribute to the facilitating the arrival of foreign extremists in Libya. The delegates expressed concern over the military escalation, which is exacerbating the situation in Libya and threatening the security and stability of the country's neighbors as well as the whole region. They urged for an end to the military conflict, arguing that political talks are the only solution to restore stability and eliminate terrorism in the North African country. The meeting came as Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the United Nations recognized the government of national accord in Libya and agreed that Turkey would provide ground, air, and maritime assistance if requested by the government.
Washington has refused to issue a visa to Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, even though, as the host of the United Nations headquarters, the United States is obliged to allow foreign officials into the country. The visa request was filed several weeks ago before the latest escalation and would give the top Iranian diplomat a stage to speak out following last Friday's drone strike, assassination of Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC Commander Qasem Soleimani, along with senior Iraqi militia leaders. They fear that someone comes to the U.S. and reveals reality, Zarif said after being denied a visa. He vowed to communicate with the American people from Tehran, noting that the world is not limited to New York. This wouldn't be the first time Washington abused its status as the host of the United Nations headquarters, refusing to issue visas for nearly a dozen members of the Russian delegation to a summit in New York last year.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well this week, the first 2 days of this week, but then their podcast links were no longer updated. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast. Get a global perspective. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's simpler than you might think, except that electronic devices create a lot of noise. If you use the internet, listening globally is even easier and noise-free. See the links at this program's website. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 23rd year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.